Okay, Daniel 5 this morning. So you want to find your place there. Making our way through Daniel. Not quite halfway, but we can smell halfway from here. So question for you. Aren't you glad that God brings evil regimes to an end? You think about that. There's been some really evil people that have been in power in the history of the race, human race, and they don't rule forever. God brings an end to their power, their authority, their ability to influence other people. I mean, Hitler no longer rules Nazi Germany today. Praise God. In fact, we don't even call Germany Nazi Germany today. Right? I mean, people travel there. It's part of the West. It's, you know, we don't even think of it in those terms. Stalin no longer leads the former Soviet Union, right? One such regime lasted for only 4 years. One of these evil regimes lasted only 4 years in Southeast Asia. Pol Pot was the communist dictator of Cambodia in the late 70s, from 1975 to 1979. Under his rule, Cambodia's borders were closed to outsiders. Religion and entertainment were outlawed. He was an evil man who enslaved his countrymen, ordering everyone into farm labor. Anyone who opposed him was tortured and killed along with their families. He's most known for the Cambodian genocide, through which he tried to cleanse the country of foreign influence. He tried to eliminate ethnic Chinese, Thai, and Vietnamese, along with practicing Christians and Buddhists as well. All told, he executed nearly 2 million of the 8 million people under his rule in just a handful of years. I mean, this is not a guy who ruled for 30 years, right? I mean, 4 years. Mercifully, Pol Pot's government was overthrown in 1979. Aren't you glad that God brings evil regimes to an end? Well, chapter 5 teaches us about this. In fact, it reinforces some things that we've already seen in Daniel. Here we see that God is sovereign over the glory of earthly kingdoms. And those who try to steal that glory, their rule will be brought to an end. So God is sovereign over the glory of earthly kingdoms. I mean, Pol Pot no doubt thought he was a glorious ruler, right? All the things that he was accomplishing in his eyes, right? People in labor camps and him thinking like, I'm getting everything out of the people here. You know, oh, I'm getting all of these evil foreign influences out by wiping all these people out. I'm really accomplishing some things. Look what I have done. We've seen that sort of behavior in kings like Nebuchadnezzar. Well, it's a few weeks ago now, but just last chapter. While we see a lot of similarities between chapter 5 and the chapter previous, chapter 4, they're right next to each other, obviously. Right. If we go back and we read chapter 4 and now we're about to read chapter 5, there's actually a lot of things that are similar. But let me clear up two things that will help us before we read chapter 5, just in terms of like knowing a little bit of the historical context and things like that. First, a literary note. Throughout the text, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, that's the king. See that in 5:1, King Belshazzar made a great feast. That's how our text begins. Okay, who is this Belshazzar guy? Well, the text refers to Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar in relationship to each other as father and son. You can see that like in verse 2 and 22 as an example. They are not father and son. Multiple generations come in between them. Think in terms of predecessor and successor when you read that. Okay? So that'll help you so you don't get mixed up. What's more, this is my attempt to, now I know you're probably up to snuff on your Babylonian, you know, king history. but just a refresher if you're a little rusty on it. So Nebuchadnezzar, who is who we have been focusing on up to this point, that's a tombstone. He died in 562 BC, okay? And then we have the succession, Evil Merodach. How would you like to have that as your name? Right? As part of your name, okay? So Evil Merodach is Nebuchadnezzar's, this is his son. But the text refers to Belshazzar as his son, but actually Evil Merodach is his son. But he only rules from 561 to 560, so just not even quite 2 years, right? And I think Nebuchadnezzar's like 30-something years. Then comes well, let me read this. Dale Ralph Davis. I commend him to you. If you want a just really helpful, readable commentary, look how thin that is for the book of Daniel, right? But he does a lot of work in the Old Testament. But listen, he kind of explains this. So follow along this little, you know, pathway here while I read, so you can kind of get a sense of, remember, we're talking about, I asked you the question, aren't you glad that God brings evil regimes to an end? Now think about these people as I kind of read through this. So as I said, Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 BC, after a reign of 43 years. In less than another 25 years, all was lost in terms of the Babylonian Empire. His son followed Nebuchadnezzar to the throne, Evil Merodach, ruling only 561 and 560. He was apparently assassinated by his brother-in-law, Nergalesar, who was there for about 4 years, and succeeded by his son, Labashi-Marduk. And this guy was assassinated also, ruling just a short time. Some think that Belshazzar, Nabonidus's son, was the real mover behind all of these conspiracies, assassinating a number of the kings. Let me just, one other thing I wanted to say here. All of these kings, as you know, in different empires, in different regions, they have sort of local gods that are their kind of pet gods, their favorite gods, right? Well, there was a shift when it came to Belshazzar. Nabonidus's father and Belshazzar, they switched kind of allegiances to a different local god and really caused a stir and really weakened the king's authority. Okay, God used that, in fact, to bring those regimes to an end, until finally Darius, which we'll read in the next, that starts the next chapter, is the first Persian king. He's known as Darius the Mede, because the Medes and the Persians are kind of one, become one kingdom. But anyway, under Belshazzar, and this is important for our text, not only does his reign come to an end, but in fact the Babylonian Empire comes to an end. So God kind of wraps up that whole evil empire. So, sorry if that got a little in the weeds, but I just thought that might be helpful as we open to Daniel chapter 5. So it's a little lengthy. We're going to have to make our way through it. Not sure we can get to it all in this Sunday, but we'll do our best. So why give you all of this? I'm trying to give you a visual of what I've started off asking. Aren't you glad that God brings evil regimes to an end? Well, we've got one after another here. And God's taking them out, and finally even replacing the entire empire with another. And you know what happens under the Persian Empire? God's people are released from exile and return. Right there, this is the Nebuchadnezzar is the one who brought Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and all the important people from Israel into exile. Right, so God brings this to an end. And uses the Persian Empire for the return from exile. Okay, so Daniel chapter 5. Listen carefully. We're always looking for repetitions. Long, Old Testament narratives often repeat a sentence to drive that into your brain, like, hey, pay attention to this. This is an important feature of this narrative. And also in narratives, you're always asking yourself the question as you're reading, what's the big problem in this narrative that that's going to have to get resolved in some way? What's the big conflict, right? Okay, so think about those things as I read. Daniel chapter 5. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the kings and his lords, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank wine and praised the god of the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately, you see you get the opening setting, right? Bring us the precious things from God's temple in Jerusalem. We're going to drink wine out of it and toast to false gods. That's what's going on as we open this text. Verse 5, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. We've seen these guys before. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Remind me to talk about the third ruler piece. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed and his color changed and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, you are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now, the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you could read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed. And whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up. And whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind and his mind was made like that of a beast. And his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox and his body was wet with the dew of heaven until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. That's a repeat, right? And you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. You have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines, have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed: Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. It's a thrilling chapter, isn't it? I mean, as I said, there's a lot of similarities between chapter 5 and chapter 6. But again, you get the sense that there's one person who's in control of who sits on the throne. And it doesn't matter how powerful that guy on the throne is, it ain't him, right? And so like I said, we see a lot of similarities, but we've got this change in regime where we're many generations later, not all that many years later, but a lot of assassinations and coups and different things. I'm not going to focus on this, but I just want to mention it to you archaeology often solidifies what we read in the Old Testament. So often we, like if you read some older commentators, you know, from like the 1800s and things like this, they'll be like, well, we just don't know about this fact, you know. And so you get maybe some argument going, controversy going between different commentators on, well, what was the next king and all this kind of thing and stuff like that. Well, it turns out that there was an archaeological dig in the mid-1800s near Babylon, and they excavated a ziggurat built in honor of the moon god, but embedded in different bricks were different historical notes. And this is like 2,300 years later, the archaeologists are digging this up. And it was there that we learned that Belshazzar had been given charge over Babylon while his father, the king, made a trip to a distant place. I forgot a guy. Nabonidus. And that's that guy. I'm sorry about that. So Nabonidus is Belshazzar's father. Okay? But you see the overlap here, 555 to 539, 553 to 539. That's because this guy was trying to switch allegiances to the local gods, and people weren't happy, and so he got shipped off somewhere. And his son sort of sat in his place. They didn't remove Nabonidus from the throne, but they sort of made him irrelevant. So that's why when he says, Daniel, you'll be the third, you know, ruler in the kingdom, my dad, me, and then you. That's what he's saying. Because that's repeated three times in the text. So that's, but anyway, isn't that awesome that, you know, we dig up, you know, in 1853 or something, some piece of history that clears it, because nobody could figure this out before, why he was saying you'll be the third high, and also nobody could figure out what was going on between these two guys. They seemed to overlap, and when they were king, and nobody could figure it out. So anyway, sometimes we just have to say, you know, we live in a fallen world and we don't have all the facts God does. We just trust his word by faith, even when it's difficult sometimes. So anyway, that's a side note. Okay. Well.
So that's what it meant by third ruler?
Yeah, that's right. Because it was Belshazzar making that offer to Daniel, right? Incidentally, you see Belshazzar, and remember Daniel's Babylonian name is Belteshazzar. It's pretty close. It means, is Bel the god? I think that's right. This means, may God save the king. And Daniel's, I think, is just sort of generic, like, may God save you. This false god, right? This Babylonian god. Okay. Well, Jeremiah 25, 11 through 12, in those couple of verses and surrounding, Jeremiah prophesied that Judah would become a ruin and a waste, and shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then after 70 years are completed, this is Jeremiah writing, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation for their iniquity, declares the Lord, making the land an everlasting waste. Well, we're seeing this come to pass in this chapter. Like Jeremiah's prophecy is coming to pass. So this is the record of how the fate of world powers goes exactly as God's plan. So in the first few verses, before we do that, I wanted to ask you, so what sort of things did you pick up as I was reading the text? It's a long text. What things did you hear or see that were either interesting, confusing, some kind of repetition, something you've seen before, any of those things?
I thought it was interesting that Daniel was allowed to say everything that he did to this king.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And that's not new, right? I mean, in chapter 1, I think we read Daniel was given the ability to interpret dreams. He doesn't actually interpret a dream in chapter 1. But man, we see this interpretation kind of theme going on and on. Like God sends this man to tell this king, like, hey, what the real story is. Right. That's interesting. That's good. What else? Gordy?
The first group of wise men come. Why wasn't Daniel in that group?
I know. You tell me. Wasn't he made? Belshazzar even says, my father, Nebuchadnezzar, made you the chief, you know, wise man or whatever, right? And yet, these generations later, nobody even knows his name. The queen has to remind, hey, I know a guy. Yeah. Have you seen that before?
Yeah.
Where have you seen that before?
The guy in jail.
Yeah, who?
Who interprets dreams? Joseph.
Yeah, Joseph, right? Do you remember that?
I know a guy.
Remember the baker and the cupbearer get sent to prison where Joseph is? Joseph is, and he interprets both of their dreams, and one of them he's like, you're going to get hung tomorrow, and you're going to get restored. And I can't remember which one's which. But he says to the one that's going to be restored to the king, hey, don't forget me. And then he does. And he languishes in prison like another, I don't know, 2 or 4 years or something. Until the Pharaoh has a dream that he can't interpret. And he's troubled, right? And somebody says, that guy that was released from prison says, oh, wait, I know a guy. I know a guy that interprets dreams. And that's what the queen does here. This is purposeful, friends. That's called an allusion. It's not a direct quote. Sometimes a writer of a piece of scripture will quote a former piece of scripture and say, you know, just as the prophet said, or as scripture proclaims, or something like that, right? This one is like it's just an allusion. It's like the pattern's there, but it's a pretty tight pattern, isn't it? It's a pattern that's so close that you're like, there's no way this was by accident. Right? So the writer of Daniel purposefully is making the reader think back to another time when a faithful man of God has the ability, as a gift from God, to interpret dreams that are going to come to a foreign king, right, about what's going to happen to them. Right?
Yeah. Well, and like, because we've read the whole chapter, Joseph's interpretation helped save the God's people because of the famine.
Yep.
And here, Persia's going to come in and take over Babylon, and it's through Persia that there won't be an exile and there'll be restoration of the wall of the temple and all that. So that's just really interesting about a huge significant, like after this interpretation of the dream to this king, foreign king, something huge in redemptive history is going to happen with God's people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So when I start off and I say, I'm talking about God bringing evil regimes to an end and the blessing of that, right? I'm not just sucking that out of my thumb. This illusion makes sure I don't miss that, right? And that's a really important one to pick up on. But there's some other things too. What else did you notice? Anything else that was, a repetition or anything like that? Or how about a big change? Think about the king, for example. Right? What's the king doing? What's this cat Belshazzar doing at the beginning of our text?
He's
drinking.
Yeah, he's partying. He's throwing a big, huge feast. You know what was happening at that time? The Persians were at the gate. History tells us that while this guy's partying, while Rome's burning, as it were, right? He's throwing this big feast, and it's not unlike we've seen kings throwing big feasts a number of times to beat their chest. Can you think of another?
Ahasuerus,
right? So we'll see that it's not an allusion back, but we see this theme, right? So what happens? So the king's like, kind of like, hey, look how awesome I am at the beginning of our narrative. What description gets repeated about the king throughout our text? Did you catch it? The queen mentions it. The narrator mentions it.
His face changes?
Yeah, his color changes, right? Yeah, I wonder why, right? In other words, he's not, as the text progresses, he becomes less convinced that he's the man, right? Which is the whole point of this chapter, right? So his color changes, and it even says when there's another point at which his wise men can't interpret, and where is that? Right before the queen comes. Verse 8, all the king's wise men come in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. Like, the lords weren't perplexed a minute ago. They were clinking glasses.
Does that mean physically his color changed? I mean,
well, it's a metaphorical expression, but we do see that there is some physical. It's like his knees gave way and his knees knocked. Like, did his knees actually knock together? I don't know, but you get the point, right? Like, he got weak in the legs, right? And we can become like white like sheet, you know, that kind of thing. Like when we're terrified, that kind of thing. Yeah, Millie.
Could we visit him? Probably, if not completely drunk halfway there, and suddenly he becomes sober.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was definitely a sober moment to see a hand writing on the wall. Even across from the lampstands, the light shining on it, right? I mean, this is extraordinary, this vision, right? Anything else before we move on? Yeah, Susan.
The beginning of the inscription is repeated.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So important. That's an easy thing to blow by, but that's the message from heaven, right? God sent that manifestation, that hand, to write that, like he sends prophets, right? Like he sends Christ into the world to preach the gospel, like he sends us into the world to take up that gospel, right? That repetition is significant, right? It's interesting. It's kind of in shorthand. It's like bullet points, and nobody can figure out what in the world this means. If we can get into the weeds a little bit on the language of it, it is a little bit ambiguous to the naked eye. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask. Do we know if this is a known language?
Yeah, it's written, I think it's in the Hebrew, and, got it in my notes what exactly it means. Let me see if I can piece it together in my memory. Give me the verse number that it's written. Do you see it there? 25 is one of them. Okay. So Mene, Tekel, and Parson can be interpreted in a number of different ways. One way is it relates to money. So Mene is like a larger sum of money. Tekel is less still, and Parson's even smaller still. I think that's part of the confusion. But mene means to weigh. Tekel means... No, mene means to count. Tekel means to weigh, and Parson means to cut. Right? So you can hear that in Daniel's interpretation. Right, he said, you know, in other words, this idea, or is it, 26. Yeah, Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. But it just says like to number up there or count or something like that. So these wise men are reading that and they're like, what does that mean? I mean, everybody's in shock because this hand has written it, right? But then they're like, what? It's like having a word up there like, you know, holiday. And we're like, what does that mean? It's kind of like that, right? So, yeah, very good. Very good. You guys picked up on a lot of good stuff. Okay, so I'll just try to cover this first point. So the first four verses, I just summarized it by describing it this way, drinking from God's cup. Drinking from God's cup. So what do I mean by this? I mean that Belshazzar interpreted his charmed life and all its riches and privileges, and he attributed it not to God's glory, but his own, right? And calling for the cup, right, for the sacred vessels from God's temple, I mean, it just underscores it, right? He wouldn't have had to do that. He could have done what Nebuchadnezzar did, walk on his wall and look out at his kingdom and done the Tom Hanks fire thing. Look what I have built, right? You know that?
Yes.
Is that okay, all right. Okay, and with the account of chapter 4 immediately preceding these events, right? We begin to shake our heads at the folly of Belshazzar simply not learning from history, right? Our text records him foolishly following his great-grandfather's prideful ways that resulted in God taking him off the throne and taking his sanity from him, right? Notice how the author purposefully identifies Belshazzar with Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 1, verse 2, we read of Nebuchadnezzar taking sacred worship vessels from God's temple in Jerusalem. This is the first time anybody's mentioned them since that time. And he says, hey, the stuff that my father took from Jerusalem, bring those to me. So there's a connection being made between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, right? The author's purposely aligning them together because they're behaving the same way. You follow me? So that's the first connection. At their most tragic moment of pride, both are connected to the palace. Nebuchadnezzar walking on its roof, that's chapter 4 and verse 29. Belshazzar throwing a party in one of its great halls here at the beginning of our text. In chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar had gathered all of the high-ranking officials to bow down to his idol and worship his gods. In our text, Belshazzar leads 1,000 of his lords along with his harem to worship the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. You heard me read that at least twice, maybe three times, right? That was a repetition.
That's like in Romans, when Paul talks about the heart of man.
Yeah, that's right.
That we turn from the glory of God and we give glory to wooden things.
Preach, brother.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, Isaiah just rails against idolatry, right? You carve a statue that can't walk, can't think, can't see, and then lift it up and set it high and bow down to it like it's your God, like it did something for you. Like it's just insane. It's the insanity of man, right? Turning from the glory of God and worshiping the creature rather than the blessed creator, right? Yeah, so all of these connections are being made between Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar. There are more. Those are three chief ones, though, right? The worship vessel connection, the moments of pride connected to the palace, right? And then this leading scores of important, powerful people to bow down to idols. They both did that. All these comparisons with Nebuchadnezzar are to show how nothing changes from generation to generation. You know, I read the names of some evil dictators, right? And there are still more today. Just as this list shows us. Nebuchadnezzar is a bad dude. He goes away and who replaces him? A guy with the name Evil. Right? And so it goes. Mm-hmm. Nothing changes from generation to generation. Men continue to rob God of his glory for the good he brings to their lives and to the lives of other people. Back in chapter 4 and verse 27, we read of Daniel urging Nebuchadnezzar to repent of his pride. Remember that? But as he considered his vast accomplishments, his wicked heart couldn't resist taking the credit. Look at chapter 4 and verses 29 and 30 real quick. This is this roof scene, right? Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? That follows the call to repent. And now 23 years after Nebuchadnezzar's death and four kings later, five if you count his father, nothing has changed. Men still interpret their success as the fruit of their own worth and power. The arrogance of Belshazzar is seen in every verse. I mean, there's not one time. Remember, we were like kind of wrestling a little bit with like, oh, I wonder if Nebuchadnezzar really came to faith. I mean, he says some things that sound like somebody that follows God would say. We don't read anything like that of this cat. Not only did he throw an extravagant celebration, but the timing of these events tell us about his arrogance. I mentioned this earlier. Although the Persian army, Dave Helm writes, had been assaulting the city for some time, it appears that Belshazzar decided to keep up the calendar tradition of holding a great feast in honor of his gods, irrespective of that fact. That just speaks of arrogance, right? Deep within the city, surrounded by the protection of massive outer walls, Belshazzar put on a drunken feast. Nothing changes from generation to generation. Men continue to deceive themselves, judging themselves as exalted and bringing about their achievements as if they did it themselves. And the actual extent or even existence of any achievements matter little. I mean, take Nebuchadnezzar. He had achieved much. He had built a great city. He had conquered all the other world powers. He ruled over them and took their treasures. Now God had given all of these things to him, but he claimed God's glory for himself. Right? This king. I mean, we read it really plainly here. Verse 18, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, and then on Daniel says what God gave him. Right? Gave him kingship, greatness, glory, majesty. Because of the greatness that he gave him, it's repeated, that God gave him, right? All peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed. And whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up. And whom he would, he humbled. But his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, verse 20 says. Right? Yeah. Belshazzar, though, wasn't like Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't break any ground. Much like the great-great-grandson of some titan of industry that built some huge company, right? This guy just, you know, was sitting in the lawyer's office having the will read and like, hey, Belshazzar, you get it all. He's a Johnny-come-lately. He didn't build anything. He was a poser. He hadn't accomplished anything. He hadn't built those great walls. He was like a son watching his dad shop while he was away. The king was living on the luxury that others had afforded him, but that didn't stop him from seeing himself as worthy of praise, praise that God deserves. Isn't it? It's insanity of sin, isn't it? I mean, it's not right, but you can kind of like see the, you know, twisted rationality of a guy that builds something going, look what I've built, right? But a guy that just inherits it, here's the keys to the kingdom, and you're like, do you see how I took that keys from him? Look how awesome I am. I mean, it's crazy. Sin just blinds you, right? I mean, and this is the set, this is the opening, this is the conflict, right? This is where this chapter opens, where we're going to be taught something very significant about how God brings evil regimes to an end, right? And praise his name, right? And all of this, of course, finally gets fulfilled. And Christ coming, his second coming, in fact, right, will bring it all to pass. But his first coming, right, dealing a death blow to death, right? But when he comes a second time, he's going to come not as a lamb, right, but as a lion, right, to claim everything that's his. And we'll get more into that as we move through this chapter. We'll have to pick that up next week. We're at time. You get the final word, Tom.
Well, I was going to say, is that where the term the writing on the wall?
It is. That's a great point. So many phrases that just the world uses originated in the Bible, right? Like a leopard won't change his spots, for example, right? Things like that. Yeah, it's pretty clear, Tom. Handwriting on the wall. It's time to sell that car, or whatever. Right. Okay. God bless you. I'll see you in service.